Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. Let's start with an article that we had started on before, entitled Our Lives Now and Then. This is just a few bits of fun information. Barbie was about to make her debut. In 1958, Mattel was producing the first prototypes for a doll named Barbara Millicent Roberts, or Barbie, which was to go on sale March 9, 1959. And now, nearing Medicare age, she's finally a Hollywood star. In 2023, the Barbie movie surpassed $1 billion in global ticket sales in just weeks. We've created a space jam. A number of satellites orbiting the Earth was, in 1958, six. In 2023, more than 11,300. And we're still intrigued by aliens. In 1958, the U.S. sealed off Area 51 near Las Vegas, sparking endless conspiracies about aliens and UFOs. In 2023, 56% of Americans 65 and older believe intelligent life exists in outer space. Then we spent a lot less of our income on prescription drugs in 1958. The annual Rx expenditure per person per year in 1958 averaged $9.93. That's the total, not the copay. Today, that figure is $1,567. Wow. We cope. In 1958, people at age 65 had survived the Great Depression, two world wars, and a flu pandemic. In 2023, we've seen the Kennedy and MLK assassinations, the Vietnam War, race riots, the Challenger disaster, 9/11, and COVID. But we're okay. Today, the older we get, the more likely we believe we're living our best possible life. We pay more for our homes. The median price of a home in 1958 in June was $19,214. That would be $202,850 now, adjusted for inflation. The June 2023 amount was $410,000. And there's much, much more in our bonus issue. You would have to go to aarp.org/bonus issue to find out, has our belief in God changed? Do we own more or fewer guns? Do we die of the same diseases? Are we living longer, living better? Now, in the same AARP, the magazine issue, we have some medical information here that we're going to go through. Let's start with an article on breakthroughs in diabetes, a continuous glucose monitoring revolution. Diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in 2004, Andy Pincus has made some radical changes. He's lost 52 pounds, walks more than 15,000 steps a day, and eats a more plant-based diet. But earlier this year, Medicare expanded coverage for continuous glucose monitors, CGM, making it significantly easier for Pincus, 70, and millions of others to manage their blood sugar levels. Once used mostly for insulin-dependent type 1 diabetes, CGM use is rising fastest in people like Pincus with type 2, who typically take medications, sometimes along with insulin, to control blood sugar. Pincus wears a patch with a glucose sensor on his upper arm that transmits blood sugar glucose data to his smartphone. I take readings several times during the day. When I see spikes, I think about what I ate that caused that. I've lost weight, and my ALC, a blood sugar average, is lower. Experts estimate the Medicare rule change makes 1.5 million more older adults, many with type 2, eligible for the devices. If private insurance plans follow suit, another 2.5 million people, almost all with type 2, will have insurance coverage. The change is one reason analysts say that by 2027, at least 5.9 million people with type 2 diabetes will be eligible for insurance-covered CGMs. That could grow to 8.4 million if private insurers also expand coverage. This is great news for patients with type 2 diabetes, says Tamara Oser, MD, who studies CGMs at the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. Compared to finger sticks, blood sugar checks, CGMs, help midlife and older adults lower their blood sugar further and keep it in a healthy range longer. In Oser's recent pilot study, which used CGMs with a lifestyle guide and a Fitbit, 67% of newly diagnosed type 2 patients obtained diabetes remission. Oser is also testing CGMs in pre-diabetes, which almost 64 million midlife and older Americans have. Meanwhile, Pincus has used his CGM to see how certain foods, as well as sleep and stress, affect his glucose levels. CGM has the ability to change lives, he said. Then we have a sidebar with more diabetes breakthroughs. An app helps you stay on track, a prescription-only smartphone app that uses cognitive behavior therapy techniques to help people with diabetes develop new habits, received FDA authorization in July. People using the AspireRx app. That's A-S-P-Y-R-E-R-X. App for 90 days saw their A1C, a measure of blood sugar control, fall significantly. And then diabetes drug sparks weight loss. In May of 22, the FDA approved tirzepatide, an injectable diabetes medication that also helps with weight loss. After approval, some dosages were in short supply as people with and without diabetes flocked to fill the prescriptions. And that one is spelled T-I-R-Z-E-P-A-T-I-D-E. On the horizon, artificial pancreas for type 2 diabetes. In January 2023, a small British study showed that an experimental artificial pancreas, a device that measures blood sugar continually and releases insulin into the bloodstream as needed, was more successful at lowering blood sugar than standard insulin injections for adults with advanced type 2 diabetes. Researchers say larger studies are needed to fully test the device. Now, breakthrough in men's health, cancer treatment from inside the prostate gland. Tommy Saul, 57, takes prostate cancer seriously. His father died after a 12-year fight with the disease, the second leading cause of cancer death in men. So when Saul was diagnosed with prostate cancer, his doctors urged radiation or immediate surgery to remove his prostate gland. Still, Saul hesitated. "I didn't like the side effects, urinary incontinence and erectile dysfunction," Saul says. "That's when we did a lot of research." Saul and his wife, Autumn, decided that he was a good candidate for TULSA-PRO, an outpatient procedure cleared by the FDA in 2019 that destroys cancerous tissue from inside the prostate gland with ultrasound heat. Doctors use magnetic resonance imaging to guide the robotic procedure, while a cooling catheter inserted in the rectum reduces heat exposure of nearby tissues. Recovery is generally faster than with surgery or radiation. It's intended mostly for men with low and intermediate risk prostate cancer that has not spread. "The goal is to minimize side effects," said Yair Lotan, MD, chief of urologic oncology at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas. In a recent study of 115 midlife and older men with low to intermediate risk prostate cancer who had their prostate gland treated completely via TULSA-PRO, 96% of participants saw their PSA levels fall by 75% or more within a year. By 3 years after their procedures, 13% needed additional prostate cancer treatment, but none had severe erectile dysfunction problems, and 99% did not need pads for managing incontinence. In contrast, 25 to 33% of men who undergo standard surgery or radiation treatment see their cancer return, according to the Prostate Cancer Foundation. Up to 23% may have lingering incontinence after surgery, and up to 50% may have ongoing ED a year or more after surgery or radiation. Then we have more men's health breakthroughs. OTC help for erectile dysfunction, a gel that helps men get an erection within 10 minutes, received FDA clearance in June. Eroxon stimulates nerves involved with erections. It's effective for 65% of men. Its maker, Futura Medical, says. Treatment eases enlarged prostate symptoms. The Optilume BPH catheter system is a drug-coated balloon that expands in the prostate gland opening, enlarging it to allow for easier urine flow. Approved by the FDA this past June, the device also releases the medication Paclitaxel to help prostate tissue heal. That's Paclitaxel. On the horizon, lab-grown hair follicles for baldness. Japanese researchers have grown hair follicles in a lab by reprogramming mouse cells, and most sprouted hairs that grew to about a tenth of an inch long. In the future, the follicles could be used to test hair loss treatments, they say. And we have, in brain health, nerve stimulation for stroke recovery. A 2020 stroke caused by a blocked artery on the left side of her brain left Kathy Reynolds, 69, unable to use her right hand. Despite extensive rehab, she couldn't knit or even cut her own food. In February of this year, Reynolds, a retired teacher from Suskasuna, New Jersey, had a new type of device implanted just below her collarbone with a wire under the skin leading to her vagus nerve. During therapy sessions and at home, she or her therapist can turn on the VNS, that's Vivisystem system, sending mild electrical pulses that nudge the brain to build new pathways. The conventional wisdom is that by a year after a stroke, there really isn't that much that helps, says Charles Louis, MD, director of Neuro Restoration Center at the University of Southern California Keck School of Medicine. But a study he co-authored found that with VNH, it's possible to achieve meaningful improvement after a stroke, actually years after a stroke. People in the study went through three intensive 90-minute in-clinic rehab sessions per week for 6 weeks, plus extra sessions at home. Those who did just the rehab program recovered some additional use of their arms and hands, but adding VNS doubled the amount of improvement. The vagus nerve connects many parts of the body to many parts of the brain, Louis notes. It's a natural antenna. The system helped about half of the users. In the future, VNS and other types of nerve stimulation may be used to jumpstart recovery of mobility in legs and feet, too, Louis notes. Studies have also looked at the effects of VNH on thinking and memory after a stroke. As for Reynolds, she has gained the ability to write with a regular pen, and she's using both hands to knit. There are pathways in my brain that haven't been working since my stroke. This is making them wake up again. On the horizon, smartwatches that catch early Parkinson's? Researchers using wrist health trackers observed a unique slowness of movement up to 7 years before a Parkinson's diagnosis. The finding could help detect the disorder earlier and possibly aid in prevention. And then more brain health breakthroughs, new Alzheimer's tests. The FDA has cleared tests that measure beta amyloid and tau proteins, which often point to Alzheimer's, in the fluid surrounding the brain and spinal cord. Early detection could allow doctors to take actions to slow the disease's progression. And magnetic brain stimulation for mental health, transcranial magnetic stimulation, TMS, has been used for depression since 2008. Now it's showing promise for anxiety, PTSD, and addictions. Now let's look at an article in the magazine called Seeing in the Dark. When aging eyes meet nighttime roadways, driving can be hazardous. Here's why we struggle to see in the dark and how you can make the road you travel safer. My wife was recently on the phone trying to arrange a dinner rendezvous for that evening with her parents, both in their 80s. How about 7, she asked, offering a time she thought was reasonable. Maybe 6 is better, her mother countered. Let's say 5, her father weighed in. Suddenly, we were scrambling to get ready, wondering why we need to rush. Turns out, he wasn't trying to catch some early bird special. The simple reason was he doesn't like driving at night. He's hardly alone. Older drivers in 2020, there were some 48 million licensed drivers over 65 in the U.S., tend to self-regulate, studies show, and they take themselves out of driving in riskier situations. The most common safety choice older drivers make is not to drive after dark. With good reason, half of all fatal car crashes happen after dark, according to data from the National Safety Council, even though only 25% of driving happens then. Drivers are less likely to wear seat belts at night, more often under the influence of alcohol, and more prone to be fatigued. But there's another big problem. Vision. Humans are born with two types of photoreceptors in their eyes, rods and cones. In the daytime, we utilize cones, the structures that allow us to see color. With the onset of night, however, we shift to a mix of rods and cones. In very, very low light, we rely entirely on rods, which is why in the darkness everything appears black and white. When you age, you start to lose rod photoreceptors before you lose cone photoreceptors, says Cynthia Owsley, the chair of ophthalmology at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. So while our vision in daytime may be just fine, our night vision becomes less acute. In people with age-related macular degeneration, this process is even more pronounced, she says. At the same time, our pupils, which regulate how much light enter our eyes, shrink with age, says John Bullock, program director at the Light and Health Research Center at Mount Sinai Hospital's Icahn School of Medicine in New York City. The older we are, the smaller our pupils are, he says. Even for the same light level, there's less light getting inside our eyeball. By the time we hit our 60s, he adds, the backs of our eyes are receiving only one-third the light they did when we were 20. The world just gets darker day by day. He says, the only reason we don't notice it is because it's so gradual. As we age, we also become less sensitive to changes in contrast and thus less able to distinguish objects, like pedestrians or road signs, from their background. As the darker it gets, the more challenged our sight becomes, especially when it's a question of spotting objects along the side of the road. A study by the University of Michigan Transportation Research Institute found that pedestrian fatalities were 22% more likely to occur in nights when there was a new and essentially invisible moon than on brighter nights with full moons. Plus, in low contrast conditions, it's difficult to estimate how far objects, such as other cars, are moving, and our reaction times are slowed. What's more, by the time we reach our late 50s, nearly 1 in 10 of us will suffer from cataracts, a blurring caused by a buildup of protein on the disc-like lenses behind our pupils. By the time we hit our 80s, more than half of us will have cataracts. Everyone who lives long enough, whether their eyes are healthy or not, will experience cataracts, Bullock says. Now let's stop here for just a minute and look at this sidebar article, How to See Better in the Dark. Driving as little as possible after dark is a safety tip number one. But sometimes, especially when the days grow shorter, that simply isn't an option. To maximize your vision, one, use your brights at night in almost all cases except when there are oncoming cars. Drivers often don't see as well at night as they think they do, and high beams give them the best chance of reacting fast enough to an unexpected hazard. Don't economize. When buying a new or used car, look for models with top-rated headlights. Go to IIHS.org/ratings to find a car's safety ratings. When given a choice, opt for the best headlights available. 3. If your car is several years old, consider getting your headlights and casings replaced. A 2018 study by AAA found that in at least two popular sedan models, degraded headlights and yellowed headlight casings meant that on low beams, the headlights were emitting just 22% of the light that new ones would provide, making night driving more hazardous. 4. Keep your windshield and headlights clean, for obvious reasons. 5. Reset the illumination levels of your dashboard lights and any in-car screens to low. Bright light inside makes it harder to see outside. And 6. Don't skip the after-dinner coffee. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration reports that in 2017, 91,000 police-reported crashes involved drowsy drivers. How to lighten up. The good news is that headlights are, in some cases, getting better at lighting the road ahead of us. A testing initiative by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, IIHS, has found that vehicles equipped with top-rated headlights have 19% fewer nighttime crashes than do cars with lower-rated lights, as opposed to older headlights, which use a halogen bulb backed by a reflective surface. The best new headlights use LED bulbs with a so-called projector lens, explains Matt Brimbelow, a senior research engineer with the IIHS. Now you can have a much better beam pattern that gets enough light onto the road, he says. But even pricey LED lights don't always ensure good illumination. You might have a really expensive headlight system that doesn't do well, he says. There are lots of LED bulbs not designed to light up the road. They may be there to make a style statement about the car brand. If you're considering a new car, and if driving at night is a concern, check out IIHS.org, which offers overall safety ratings on vehicles, including for headlights. Still, having the best headlight is only half the battle. You also need to use them well, especially your high beams. In fact, most of us use our high beams a lot less than we could. Curiously, he points out, low beam headlights initially weren't ever really designed to be the main headlights for us to be driving with. They were called the passing beams, he says. And then you had the driving beams, which were your high beam headlights. Over time, owing perhaps to busier roadways and more street lights, we've defaulted to using our passing beams for much of our driving. Even on dark rural roads without much traffic, some three-quarters of drivers typically use their low beams, according to Bullock. As a result, many drivers are overdriving their headlights, driving faster than they would be able to stop based on what their headlights can reveal in front of them. But while lighting the road ahead is one battle, there's another issue that confounds and distracts nighttime drivers: the headlights from oncoming cars. Driving at night, you may find yourself occasionally getting flashed by oncoming drivers, protesting your use of high beams, even when you're using low beams. It's relatively easy to put a lot of light on the road, Brumblebrose says. The issue is that you have to do that without glaring other drivers. And in the U.S., headlights tend to have a sharp cutoff, a sort of line where it's bright below, dark above, Bilbro notes. So when an oncoming car hits a bump, it may look to you as if the driver is flashing his headlights. Fortunately, a solution for visibility and glare may soon be at hand. Adaptive driving beams headlights, already common in other parts of the world, have recently been approved by regulators for use in the U.S., though it will be some time before they appear on the American vehicles. Adaptive headlights feature a camera that helps direct LED bulbs away from oncoming cars, while your side of the road would still be fully lit by high beams. Adaptive lights could give drivers about 165 to 195 extra feet of visibility, which at 65 miles per hour translates into a couple of seconds of additional reaction time. This could be a boon for older drivers. It almost brings you back to what you could see with a low beam in your 20s. Now, I know a lot of our listeners don't drive, but hopefully you can pass this information on to the people who do. Now, I think we have time for one or two articles from real people. Let's look at rock climbers. Facing down fear. To understand her daredevil son, Deirdre Wolanek followed in his footsteps. I was hanging 2,200 feet above a rocky canyon floor when fear took over. Halfway up Lover's Leap, a 400-foot rock face in the Sierra Nevada, I was paralyzed, totally focused on my fear. This was my first big climb and could have been my last. Someone handed me a rope, but I couldn't grab it. Let me start at the beginning, at ground level. For years, I've seen news photos and videos of my son, Alex Honnold, a world-renowned climber. And I'd tell myself, that can't be right. That can't be what he's doing. I was terrified of heights, for myself and for him. Finally, at age 60, I decided I needed to understand what he was doing. So I asked him to take me to a local climbing gym. That's how I started doing it myself. At the gym, I was usually the oldest climber. I lacked the body strength the younger climbers had. But once I learned the skills, 90% of my fears for Alex disappeared, because now I understood how careful climbers are and what they do to protect themselves. That day on Lover's Leap, I had to figure out whether my fear was a rational one. I should listen to a false perception I should talk myself out of. I knew if my climbing partners were afraid, I needn't be. So I talked myself through my fear and grabbed the rope. I made it to the top. And since then, I have gone on many more climbs. At 66, I became the oldest woman to scale El Capitan, the iconic cliff that towers more than 3,000 feet above Yosemite's valley floor. On my 70th birthday, I did it again, celebrating with cake atop the monster granite wall. As we age, we have reasonable concerns about falling, breaking a bone. Our bodies are different as our minds, but some things stay the same. There's a battle with fear you have to win if you're going to do anything worthwhile. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.